so good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second of our sessions thinking about careers, and particularly distinguished careers that chemists have followed. We're delighted today to welcome Professor James Stapleton, who's currently the Master of Christ's College. Professor Stapleton started out life as a chemist, doing her first degree and then graduate studies in Australia, and then spent a period here in Cambridge doing a postdoc in this department, and then made the decision to shift away from chemistry, and she pursued a very distinguished career in the law. Now, of course, it's not at all uncommon for chemists to pursue careers elsewhere, and we know that chemistry is, of course, a very good basis for any kind of career you would like to pursue. And as Professor Stapleton shows, it certainly set her up in a way which she's perhaps going to describe in a moment for a very successful career in the law. So thank you, Professor Stapleton, for joining us today. We look forward to hearing your description of how you got to where you are. At the end, which will be about 20 minutes when Professor Stapleton will talk, Nick Bampos will be happy to take any questions. And if you'd like to put questions into the chat function, please, and then Nick will organise those as we get towards the end of the session. So, Professor Stapleton, welcome and thank you very much.
Thanks, James. First of all, I should say thank you for having me. Being a lapsed chemist, you're very tolerant, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the students. This is really going to be just the story of my life. I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney in Australia. My father was an academic electrical engineer, but I had the very great good fortune that my mother had been to university. She'd attended a very modest parish school, but she'd won a scholarship to the University of Sydney, where she read mathematics. This was during World War II. After graduation, she worked on radar, which, of course, at that time was a very exciting field. After the war, when my parents got married, my mother had to leave her job because that was the rule for married women at the time. But it didn't mean that I grew up in a household where for a female to be interested in maths and science wasn't at all freakish. Now, at school, I never came top of my class. I never came second. I never came third. I coasted along happily. I enjoyed maths and science, but I also enjoyed Latin. And my school results were adequate, but they would not have gotten me into a professional degree course like medicine or law. So I took the path of least resistance and did a general science degree, beginning in first year with mathematics, physics, chemistry, and biology. Now, in later years, I specialised in chemistry, mainly because at school I'd been taught by nuns, whom I'm afraid knew next to nothing about chemistry. So it was in chemistry that I had to scramble at university to keep up with the work. It's hard to emphasise enough how poor my introduction to chemistry at school had been. I remember distinctly at the beginning of my penultimate year at high school, so I would have been about 16, when Sister Ignatius unfolded a large map which introduced us to something she called the periodic table. Suddenly, what had been until then for me a course of pretty much like cooking, you added A and B together over a Bunsen burner and you end up with C, rather like cooking an egg, now became intellectually understandable and what's more predictable. Anyhow, the bottom line of all this was that in my undergraduate years, I concentrated on chemistry to catch up. And because I put in the time and effort, I found it really rather enjoyable. That was at the University of New South Wales, where most people graduated after 3 years with a bachelor's degree without honours. About well, less than 10% of the class then went on to do a full year of research for which they'd be awarded honours. I was really lucky. My research project fell out very neatly, clear results. So as a result of that, I was told towards the end of the year that I would probably get a first class degree. I hadn't thought of going on to a higher degree until then. I'd missed all the deadlines for overseas universities, so but I was in time for a domestic scholarship, so I applied for that, got that. I went to the University of Adelaide, where I started a PhD in mass spectrometry, being supervised by Professor John Bowie. Now, John had done a postdoc at Lenzhou Road with Lord Todd. I started in 1974, and it just so happened that the University of Adelaide was celebrating its centenary that year. One dimension of that celebration was that the university invited a global star in every discipline to come over and visit the university. Chemistry invited Lord Todd. So this was how it was that one day in my lab in Adelaide, John appeared at the door, the large, huge presence, the great Lord Todd. How strange life turns out that I now have the privilege of living in the same master's lodge as he did. Anyhow, I finished research for my PhD at the University of Warwick because it had acquired the only MS50 mass spectrometer in the UK, and it was a very powerful machine for me to complete my research on. I then arrived here in Cambridge to take up a postdoc with Dudley Williams in his group. In fact, Dudley had two groups, the mass spec people like me and an NMR group. It was during my postdoc that I found myself, embarrassed to say, looking at the clock, waiting for the time when I could decently leave the lab. Now, I knew this wasn't a good sign. I didn't want to spend 40 years in a lab waiting to go home. To cut a long story short, I went back to Australia, retrained as a lawyer, came over to Oxford to do a DPhil, stayed, which I studied in taught law at Balliol College, and then I taught at Balliol for about a decade. And then I had a strange 20-year period teaching partly in the US, and in effect having a research job in Australia, at the Australian National University. So over the years since I left chemistry, many people have asked, why did I do that? But it wasn't really until I had a long conversation with David Klenneman just after I became Master at Christ's that I think I was able to crystallise the intellectually respectable reason why I left chemistry. People have different sorts of minds, I think, and mine is attracted to the exploration of foundational principles. This is probably because I have actually a very bad memory for detail. In any case, it explains why discovering that there was such a thing as a periodic table was such a transformative moment for me. But another aspect of how I like to think was that which I was able to put into words when I was having this talk with David, was that I think I'm attracted to puzzles. And the way science had been taught in my day, students were not exposed to any puzzles until after they had digested years and years of courses about things that were already worked out. I suppose I might still be a chemist if, while I'd been learning all about ketones and aldehydes, someone had explained to me some cutting-edge research problem which needed a knowledge of ketones and aldehydes to solve. Of course, David made the practical point that it's hard to get an audience of students for material that isn't examinable. So I understand the dilemma. If I'm honest, another reason why I left chemistry in the late 1970s is because I had never even seen a female academic chemist. There were none at the University of New South Wales, none at the University of Adelaide, none at Warwick, and none that I met at Cambridge. So one of the great revolutions that's happened in science since that time is that the doors to its faculties and research labs have been cast open to groups like women who had not been welcomed before. So let me just say a bit about life after chemistry. It's probably not clear to you at the moment, but a training in science prepares you for a great many things other than science. I certainly didn't realize it at the time, but I found, for example, that my interest in foundational principles translated easily when I came to study law. A law isn't a science, it's a social practice, so many of its principles are actually contestable. They're up for grabs, and that's why we have litigation that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. But underlying areas of law, there do exist foundational legal principles that are stable and on which everything else is built. So, for example, I became interested in the concept of causation, or maybe I should say the concept of causation as it underlies legal principles. A great advantage of being interested in foundational ideas like this is that your research is highly portable. And that's why I've been able to operate across many legal systems. A question I'm often asked is whether my scientific knowledge or background has been an advantage in my career as a lawyer. Well, it has, but not in the way some people thought it would be. When I was retraining as a lawyer, it was often suggested to me that when I graduated, I could become a specialist in forensic law or maybe patent law. Well, I remember going to as an undergraduate law student, going to the library and pulling out a book on forensic science. I won't tell you what the illustrations and photographs in that book contain, but let me tell you, I didn't read a murder mystery for about 5 years afterwards. So disturbing were the images of real people in that book. So that well and truly put me off the idea of specialising in forensic science and law. What about patents? Well, here I must admit I found the text way too daunting and advanced. So when I came to choose my doctoral project, in law, I chose something in a core private law field, but that did have echoes of my science background. I was interested in how law was reacting to the wave of non-traumatic injuries that were becoming more and more well-known in society. Of course, for me, as a former chemist, the most obvious example was the thalidomide tragedy. These were birth defects caused by a pharmaceutical which had been prescribed to pregnant women for the relief of certain pregnancy symptoms. Interestingly, thalidomide is now used for the treatment of leprosy and certain cancers. So in a way, my research started out in an area where my confidence about chemical matters was a help. But it isn't the case that I have ever used any detailed knowledge of chemistry in my legal career. And I think that's probably true of most others who leave chemistry. What you do take with you are certain intellectual disciplines, such as a concern with precision and rigor, attention to methodology, and so on. For me, I'd say the most important impact was that my science background gives me a basic confidence in maths and science. And it's a confidence that I'm afraid to say most lawyers don't have. Most lawyers will stop reading an article if they see numbers, let alone a mathematical equation, let alone a chemical formula. This means people with a science background, of course, have a huge advantage. But it's actually also bad for the legal system when you find an issue being discussed in the court that requires an understanding of STEM concepts, with no one in the room really comfortable and on top of them. But a science background can be really useful in lots of other areas too. I once met a woman at a law conference in China who was a science journalist. And we compared notes about moving out of a conventional science career into something else. And she certainly has had an extraordinarily interesting career in journalism, where, a bit like in the law, most practitioners don't have real confidence navigating scientific concepts. Over the years, I've met many other people who've originally trained in science, where this sort of confidence I'm talking about has been invaluable. For example, there are a lot of areas of the civil service where this general competence is really vitally important. And if you're in many fields of commerce, production, or management, you're likely at some point to be dealing with people who are scientists or engineers or technicians of some sort. So being able to be in some sense on their wavelength can be a really valuable social skill. So I think I'll just leave it there. I hope I've touched on some of the things that may be of interest to you. And of course, I'm happy to take any questions that you might have about my weird and wonderful trajectory. Thank you.
Jane, that's absolutely wonderful. Thank you for making what must at times have been a difficult career seem so eloquently simple and straightforward, and you know, going from success to success. Now, as Dr. Keeler mentioned at the beginning, if you've got some questions, please just register them using the chat function. You're very, very welcome to register your questions, and I'll ask those in a sort of controlled way. It seems it's an easier way to do it like this rather than trying to identify you and bring you in. But just to give everyone a little bit of time, you said early on there were decisions to be made about career changes. Were there any particular obstacles in your career that you felt at the time may have been insurmountable? And how did you think you got over those obstacles career-wise?
Do you mean in chemistry or in law?
On both. So the transition maybe from chemistry into law or in law?
I certainly think when you leave a discipline after, 8 years, you feel frightened and you've lost your bearings. You think, you've identified as a chemist, or you thought that's where you'd be ending up. And so it does require you to remember that other people have done it and been happy, and that your identity isn't tied up with being a chemist or whatever field you're leaving. I remember the first law class I attended. So I'm in my late 20s, and these were first years straight out of school, all of whom would have qualified for their place at law school by virtue of their school results, which, as I explained, I would not have done. And I felt very unsure that I would be able to cope with law. And I remember distinctly after the first term, we had a little test in contract law, and the marks went up and I passed, and I suddenly thought, maybe I can get through this degree. So I think it does knock your confidence, or at least you have to build your confidence up again. But you find out really quickly that, unlike those students straight out of school who've been very, very successful at school, that having done a degree in science, you know how to study, you know how to organize yourself. As I say, you do take the intellectual training. You don't appreciate your receiving, but you are receiving it. And you can take that into whatever other field you enter. And within months, or certainly a year or so, you appreciate that you haven't wasted the years in doing chemistry. You have actually gained a lot of intangible talents that you'll be able to deploy very effectively elsewhere. It's really hard to explain how it was a great training for law. It was a wonderful, and it may not seem this way when you're actually studying chemistry as an undergraduate, but But that's actually quite diverse because you're learning a lot of information, but you're also learning how to put it together. You're appreciating the importance of note-taking, and how methodology is essential, how to put together an argument that actually holds water. So there are lots of skills that are transferable. And I luckily, I mean, for me, law was a perfect fit, but I've seen former scientists, a lot of former chemists, in really a lot of different things. And also actually law. I mean, some of the students I taught in Oxford, you know, became BBC journalists or so many different things you can do with law as well. And for the same reason that you're acquiring portable skills.
In that case, what you're saying is you're a very different lawyer having done being a scientist early on than if you'd just been a lawyer from the very, very beginning.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason I actually got into law school at the Australian National University was that they, Canberra is the national capital, so it has a very big public service, civil service there. And they created a particular law degree. In Australia, most lawyers come from school and they do two degrees simultaneously, arts and law, as you know, probably, Nick. And after 5 years, you get two degrees. Well, they did a pure law degree for people. I was a mature age student. So these degrees were actually aimed at the civil servants. And because they were for mature age students, you could get in on whatever you'd done since school. And whatever I'd done was chemistry. So chemistry got my position in law school. But it did mean that the cohort of the mature age students, we went through together. Some of us were ex-scientists, some of us were ex-humanities. And the interesting thing was, the scientists took to law really well. And some of the people who'd done humanities found it much more difficult because it's not about eloquence and expression. You know, okay, if you end up being a barrister, advocacy is going to be important. But law is about precision. And it's about actually being secure in the steps in your argument. So it's very much like the sort of logical thinking that you acquire in a scientific training. So we found the transition very easy.
I mean, it's wonderful to hear that because for all the wonderful things Cambridge offers, it can be sometimes a little inward looking. And we really do get caught up in the discipline in which we specialize. And to move away feels like you failed in the discipline that you're in. And what we tell many undergraduates is use it as a launching pad. Mm. We know in the sciences, biochemists, material scientists, physicists, and even people that go into sort of experimental psychology, they like chemists because they come with some fundamental understanding of how to deal with evidence. And you explained very nicely how you took this into working in law. In terms of diversity of experiences, the other thing that makes, I mean, I also coming from Australia, looking at sort of the diversity of the community in the time that I was a student, when I look at the 25 years I've been in Cambridge has changed a lot. We're a much more diverse community. So not just the intellectual challenges, but cultural challenges also are difficult to come to terms with. How did you cope with, I call it culture shock coming from Australia. How did you deal with a culture shock coming from a place like Australia to Cambridge and Oxford? How did you deal with that transition? Did you feel like it was a culture shock? Was it a logical transition in your career?
It is a culture shock. But I don't know about you, Nick, but when I came as a graduate student to Oxford, all the foreigners stuck together. It was a way where you could, without offending anyone, complain about the weather. And at that stage, food. I mean, you couldn't get food on a Sunday in Oxford for love nor money that you'd want to eat. Of course, things have completely changed now. I think it's and let's face it, anyone from most parts of Britain coming to Oxford or Cambridge, these are weird places. And it's a culture shock for locals too. If you're lucky and you're in a lab or a college that is full of normal people, you suddenly realise that it's a beautiful time to be around beautiful buildings, surrounded by really smart people. I remember when I was elected a fellow at Balliol, and you know, I was really daunted by this prospect of how was I going to cope in the senior common room with all these people. And what I found is that people just accepted you. And I think that is the key to feeling comfortable in a place. If you feel uncomfortable, it could well be coming from you rather than people actually making you feel uncomfortable. And I looked around me and I felt no one was frowning at me. No one was anything other than normal. Well, apart from some strange eccentrics, but we won't go into those. So I think feeling comfortable is at least half your job.
No, that's a very elegant way to put it. Sometimes we're our own worst enemies. And I mean, in many ways, I found many things about Cambridge sometimes frustrating, but also rather extraordinary. In terms of you followed an academic path as a lawyer. And it's interesting that scientists that we know who've gone on to do law, they either go very much into practicing law full time or doing academic law, not very much of both. Is that true? And why did you gravitate towards a more academic route? Is that because of your research background?
No. When I graduated, I always assumed I'd be an academic lawyer. Mainly because I had no law in my family. You know, I didn't have any connections with the legal profession at all. And so, for example, to be a barrister, I had no connections. And at that stage, when we're, you know, talking the 80s now, you really needed contacts to succeed at the bar. So I could see that was just not viable. Also, I think I'm interested in ideas and research. And, you know, academics, as you all know, we go down deep, deep holes of issues. A practitioner has to be like a taxi. Your client comes in and you have to go with them wherever their case is taking you. And if you're a barrister, the same thing. So you have to be a jack of all trades and you don't get the time to pursue anything in depth. So I thought intellectually being an academic would also be more congenial. But I have done consultancies throughout, and most of those have engaged my scientific confidence. So I've done a lot of pharmaceutical work, consultancies, pollution cases. So, for example, asbestos. Asbestos causes two types of asbestos cancer. The etiology of those cancers is unknown. What do you do then when someone has been exposed to a series of employers exposing them to asbestos? They end up with the mesothelioma cancer. Each employer is going to say, you can't prove it's me because you don't know the etiology. So I was involved in a lot of those cases, getting the legal system to find a way of managing scientific uncertainty. So most of my consultancies have been touching on areas in which having confidence of numbers or scientific comments concepts has been useful. And that's why I made the dig in my remarks about how extraordinary it is to see lawyers handling things where they really should have. I keep saying to my colleagues in practice, you need a statistician, for example. You need to have more experts in your camp. I must admit, I was friends with someone who's on the House of Lords who invited us to come and see a case and come to lunch. This was when it was in the House of Lords. And very kindly, he selected a patent case because he thought that would interest me. So I had to read the Court of Appeal decision. I didn't understand anything about it. And I certainly didn't really understand about the hearing in the House of Lords. But what was really interesting is that the barristers in that case were experts. And behind the judges was sitting a patent expert who was advising them. But there's too little of that. Law really does need more scientific expertise.
Okay, well, I'm keeping an eye for some of our students to submit some questions, and I'm sort of weave them into the discussion. You touched on what you found in Cambridge when you came as a young female scientist. And when I talk to female scientists here who were here in the 60s and 70s, I must admit, I'm not just trying to be younger and sort of generationally more progressed. I'm really quite shocked with what you hear about what women had to face a generation ago. Both in law and in science, do you think things have changed? And being a head of house in a Cambridge college, do you recognise this as now being a world which is more inclusive and which helps all our students meet the aspirations that they set for themselves?
Absolutely. There's no great surprise to tell you that Lenshill Road in the 1970s was not a welcoming environment for women. As I said, there were no. I never met an academic woman, either on the faculty or indeed visiting. They may have been some visitors in lab somewhere, but you never saw them, and they never went to the tea room. I mean, I literally never saw. When I realised there were no women in the tea room, I must admit I also voted with my feet. But so things are completely different now. And what's real when I started at Balliol, so that's the late 80s. It was still the case that people would say sexist things occasionally. And I'm happy to report I haven't heard anything like that for a couple of decades. So I think in terms of welcoming women, my experience over the last, well, this century has been very, very positive. And again, you can be your own worst enemy thinking someone's having a dig at you because you're female. It might just be that they find you a bit of a pain, whatever your gender is. So you've got to be a little bit robust. But compared to the environment that did exist, it's been transformed. And I think that's because people appreciate how much talent is lost when you're not inclusive. By being inclusive, You all rise because the institution becomes higher quality. There was a wonderful article about the Supreme Court and how few women are on appellate courts and so on. And the way the person writing the article put it was, if talent's distributed equally, which we all believe, then there must be some underqualified male judges taking the place of people females who would be better qualified. And I think certainly from what I can see, science has opened up marvellously to talented women.
I mean, statistically, yes. I mean, scholarship only benefits from attracting the best, and to really distance 50% of the population seems really nonsensical. And certainly the view we've adopted in the department, and I think this generation, is that women are not the problem. It's the men who are the problem. And if we're going to solve this, it's not just, as we said just before we started, you can't burden our female colleagues with fighting the fight, that we all have to do this together. And it is important to have female lecturers and female role models. But sometimes it seems that some women get a really tough time when they're experts. I mean, there is another famous chemist who went on to do law and going to politics in this from Oxford. And she had a bit of a tough time, but she was extraordinary. I mean, what's your view, for example, as a chemist lawyer, when you look at Margaret Thatcher, without being political, just as a career?
I think she was steely. And I think her steeliness, part of that might have come from her experience as a female chemist. I don't know. I haven't read biographies of her to explain that. I think she probably. I have read that she retained an interest in science as prime minister, and that I can't remember what the particular policy issue was, but she'd actually read the science behind it. And, a former fellow of this college gave a very famous lecture about the two cultures. He was a scientist, then he operated in Whitehall and was horrified to report, as I'm doing about lawyers, how few civil servants had any scientific grounding. And I think Dominic Cummings has the same sort of view, that it's a real problem for the nation if the people who are governing it, either as politicians or as civil servants, don't have confidence in scientific concepts. So I think, for everyone's sake, people with scientific training need to think about all the different careers they might deploy those expertises in. And I think you made the point earlier about leaving science feeling a failure. I think it's the opposite. You have such a kit of talents to bring to bear and to offer society. You just have a wealth of options where you will bring those gifts.
I think that's a really nice piece of advice for our students. Maybe there are many sort of finalists who are thinking about what they do beyond their undergraduate career. And we do tell them that life is just full of possibilities for them. They just have to feel confident, just take those possibilities. And you've shown a wonderful way how you can do this to really change disciplines. Just so we can wrap up, I think there aren't many other questions that have come through, and people may, and you've got a very busy schedule. And just to wrap up, is there any advice that you could give to those listening about what to do next in their lives? What's your sort of, maybe a piece of advice that you would have given your younger self, or something that you think that our students should take away with them beyond this academic year?
I'm not the sort of person who says, oh, if I had my time again, I regret doing this. And I actually, if I had my time again, I would not go straight from school to do law. I'm glad I did chemistry. Because of the things it gave me. I think if you're in your final year and you're wondering whether to go on, for example, in chemistry, I would talk to people about what research is like. What is a research life? Because that would be the next stage for a number of years. And ask people, what is research really like? Is it narrowing or is it broadening? And I think I didn't really ask myself that question after I went from undergraduate to, I just fell into the PhD in chemistry. And I think at that stage, I should have been asking questions about what sort of a life I wanted. Was I a teacher? And if I was a teacher, maybe I should be teaching chemistry in school rather than at university. And what are the career openings for me? What would a career in industry look like? At the time I made the key decisions to do the PhD, to do the postdoc, I still hadn't talked to anyone who had a career in chemistry, in industry. And I don't know how you deal with it at Lancer Road, but having people from industry to come in and talk about those careers would be useful. Because, as I say, I can't report what that would be like. But also I think the major piece of advice is nothing's forever. I made a mistake. I made a decision at the age of 18 that led me into an area, but I retrieved it. I don't regret what I did. And so whatever you decide in the next 12 months, you can reverse it.
Thank you. That's beautiful and wisely put. I mean, our admiration, for a wonderful career. It's great to see someone. I mean, it's one of those rare opportunities where I, as an Australian, could say a great sense of pride seeing sort of fellow Australians have done so terrifically well. And your reputation, even your career here as head of house at Christ, has been fantastic, which is the reason why we approached you. So thank you very, very much for your time. Thank you for those thoughtful words. I'm sure that our students really appreciate what you've said, and what we'll do, you very kindly offered to allow us to record this, so those who were not able to join us today because of teaching commitments, we will give them a chance to hear what you've said today. So thank you very, very much for your time. All the best for the rest of the academic year. We know it's been very, very busy in all the colleges, and all the very best to our students this term, and we'll stay in touch. But I guess the deal is let's stay happy, stay resilient. And thanks to the photography team for organizing the technical bits of this, because most of us are really quite lost at times. So have a lovely day, everyone. And Professor Stapleton, thanks again.
And can I wish all the students all the best this term?